My name's Gilbert, and I'm an alcoholic. And when I was asked to speak, I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And then Scott started giving me phone calls about you need to wear a suit and tie. So any of y'all that know me, I really don't like that. I'm in a T-shirt and blue jean kind of guy. So I bet the requirement.
Thank you.
Now, I feel a lot more comfortable. All right. So what I'd like to say is, you know, when I started in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in the treatment center at the local VA, and it was a homeless deal, and they would bring us to different meetings. And 30 years ago, in 1993, there was a AA prepaid convention right here, and I heard some of my first speakers in this room 30 years ago. So I hate to be one of those guys that say back in the day when I came in AA, but back in the day when I came in AA, you know, it was the same program. That's the real truth. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has not changed one iota. Today we have in the Augusta area, and I found out in Charleston, Savannah, and through my network that there's all kinds of different treatment centers now helping getting people to get sober, and I think that's a pretty awesome thing. But the one thing they don't have is what AA does have, and that's the 12 traditions. We're not out to make a dollar or a dime. We're only here to help the next suffering alcoholic get over that insidious obsession. And I think that's why we'll last longer and longer and longer. And so hopefully in another 30 years, I'll be back to speak again. So what I'll do is I'm just going to start with my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And hopefully, I was talking to the guy doing the tape, and I said, I'll get sober by the end of this thing. So a lot of people don't. Sometimes people get up here and they speak and they never get sober. But I plan to get sober and I plan to work the steps and all that good stuff, you know. I tell you what, but let's get rolling. I started drinking when I was 13 years old. I remember my first drunk. It was a six-pack of Carling Black Label beer given to me by the boys on the block. I'm from Western Pennsylvania, a small town called Katanning. And you know, we were a bunch of baby boomer kids, and we were wild childs, and we did what we wanted to do. I was the last of five children, and my mom was in her 50s when I was a teenager. And so she was tired, you know. She said, you can do whatever you want to do as long as you graduate high school. And I took that football and I ran with it. So I started drinking. I was academically inclined, but I didn't think that was cool to be academically inclined. You know, I think I should have been more like a Urkel, but I wanted to be more like a hippie. So, you know, I wasn't comfortable in my own skin, I guess you could say. I don't know, but I had a good time as a child, normal childhood. But when I started drinking, I liked drinking more than I do anything. And so by the time, I'm going to tell you this, there's a lot of drugs in my story, too. And so I was duly addicted at one point, and we're going to talk about that because it affects my alcoholism and why I got sober. But at any rate, so I started drinking, you know, at age 13 on weekends. By the time I was 14, I started that initial hippie drug use that they had in the 70s, all those initial drugs like DMT, LSD, and all those things, PCP. That's a tongue twister. But I was doing all that kind of stuff, and, you know, as long as I brought home decent grades, my mom really didn't care. So what happened, when I was 17 years old, I had my first overdose, and I overdosed on LSD. And I took it on a Friday night, and by Sunday morning, I was still out there somewhere around Pluto. And I told my mother, I said, you know, you better take me to the hospital because I took this drug, and I cannot come down. And they took me to the hospital, I was hallucinating severely, and by Tuesday they had given me enough medicine that I could sleep. By Wednesday I went to one counseling session. On Thursday I was let out of the hospital. On Friday I was back in school, and on Saturday I was in Pittsburgh at a rock concert partying again and pretended that nothing ever happened. So that was when I was 17 years old. When I was, by the time I was 18 years old, I was still partying. It didn't stop me, but I wanted to get out of my little town because I had an ego, and I thought I was, I was afraid to let people know me on one hand, but on the other hand, I thought I was better than everybody else, you know, so it was kind of confusing in my brain. So I decided to join the United States Army. I went in about 130 pounds, 5'11", and they, in their infinite wisdom, decided to make me a military policeman. And so I get there, and I get shipped to Germany, and that's where I became a professional drinker. I loved alcohol. The Army wasn't like it is today, where they have RTF and treatment centers and counseling and raise your little card if your emotions are hurt and all that. But what they did have is beer machines in the barracks, okay? And we emptied them every night. Then, you know, being in Germany, I learned to drink Jägermeister and wine and schnapps and all those good things. And I smoked a little hashish, but I didn't want to do drugs too much because, you know what? I didn't want to do drugs and then arrest people for doing drugs. But that didn't stop me from drinking. I'd have to arrest people for drunken driving, but that didn't stop me from drinking. You know, so I set my own rules, my own standards, and I drank every day so much that by the end of my 3-year term in the military, they did not ask me to re-up, and I didn't want to re-up. And I did what any good alcoholic does. I went home to bother Mom, you know? And I went home to my home little old little town up there in Appalachia and got a job. And, you know, after a while, I thought I was better than everybody else again, but I was afraid to let anybody know me. And so I went off to a major college. I went off to Penn State. And after 3 years, Penn State decided they didn't need me anymore. I had drank my way out of that also. So I did what any good alcoholic does. I went home to bother Mom. And I moved in again. I got a nice job at a telephone company. And back then, telephone companies weren't automatic. Everything wasn't automatic like we have today. We literally still had people working in the offices, pushing buttons. We still had people. All mail was not email. It had to be delivered by hand. And I was that guy. And the telephone company had like 6 buildings in my county, and what I did is I delivered mail all around to these buildings, and there were women in every office. 200 women in this office, 70 women in this office, 30 women in this office. And so when I went out on weekends, you know, I had this big ego. This was back in the Michael Jackson era, you know. So that was when I still had a Jerry curl. You know, messing up pillows. Those of you that had Jerry curls know what it's like to mess up a pillow. And I had the leather jackets and dancing, and everything was good. Drinking was still fun at that time because I thought, you know, if I lose a job, I just go get another one. If I get kicked out of school, I just go get a job. Well, what happened was I got kicked out of the phone company. And I had used up all the jobs in my little hometown, and my friends asked me, what are you going to do? And I just looked at them while sitting at a bar, and I said, guess what? Never been to Florida before. Let's do that. So 3 of us jumped in my car. We went to Florida. One got kicked out for stealing a car. The other one, and by the way, I had started doing cocaine in the 80s, started snorting cocaine. And so when I got to Florida, though, they had this white smokable alcohol, we'll call it. And so I started doing that on weekends while I was drinking every day and had a job. And next thing I know, I moved in a house, and they were doing it. And on weekends, it was really good. I was having a good time fishing and all kinds of things down there. But all of a sudden, one day I smoked some of that white smokable alcohol, and I got scared. something happened inside me. I knew that I was addicted to this stuff. And I was about to cry, and I felt that I did not want to have other people see me cry, so I went outside, and it was dark, and there was back in Florida, they had a canal that ran behind the house, and then your little embankment, and then the house, and I was sitting out there in the dark by myself, and I had a negative spiritual experience. The voice came to me while I was sitting there crying, and it said, "Do you want to feel better?" And it was just as clear as I'm talking to you today. And I said, "Yes, I do." And it said, "Get up, go back inside, and have another hit." And so I cleaned off my glasses and wiped the tears off my face and stuff. And I went back in there and I went. And the next thing I know, I told myself the lie that every addict and alcoholic tell themselves, that I can do this addiction and I can live the normal life that I was raised to live. And needless to say, 5 years went by very quickly, about 5 and a half. And those of you who have been addicted to other things other than alcohol know that strange things happen to you. You get, you say hello to people and they got a gun in your face. You might wind up smoking macadamia nuts. I still thought of myself somehow as being this guy that achieved military, I did the military successfully, but one time when I was out there trying to get that white smokable alcohol, I was beat up by a group of 15-year-olds, and that was very, very humiliating to me. But you know what I did when I got beat up by them 15-year-olds? I went to my friends. Did I get them to go whoop some butt? No, we just pulled our money and went for more, because that's what I got. I got a disease of more, and it don't care what it is, whether it's a disease of alcohol, whether it's alcohol or drugs, I want more, So anyway, about 5 and a half years go by, and I wind up homeless and vagrant, and all these things happen to me in Florida, and I decided I wanted to get off that drug, and I came up with a plan, and I don't recommend it, but it's what happened. It's the plan I came up with. I decided that every time I wanted to go get that white smokable alcohol, that I would drink so much that I physically could not walk to go get it. It worked. After about 8 months and a couple relapses in there, I was off of that, and that addiction was broken. However, I had this problem. Now I'm drinking 24/7. If I was awake, I had a drink in my hand. I supported myself through day labor. I was homeless. Again, vagrant. So I was going to do what any other good alcoholic does. I was going home to visit Mom. Only this time I'm in Augusta, Georgia. It's around 1989, 90 or 91. I'm not sure what year. I'd have to go look it up. But what happened was she said, "Don't come here no more. And don't call your brother in Detroit. And don't call your brother in California. Don't call your sister in Philadelphia. And don't call your best army friend in Connecticut. Because I told them all not to have anything to do with you." And I was heartbroken. And I wound up in a rescue mission here in Augusta. And I told them, I said, there's 7 billion people on the planet and me. And no, I don't give a shit. I don't care about none of them. Sorry, Scott. I don't care about none of them, and none of them care about me. So that's where I landed. And I was there about 16 months, and I was mean to my fellow homeless people. And the next thing you know, some of them said, "You know what your problem is?" I said, "No." And they said, "You need to have a beer and relax." So I worked in the homeless shelter, and I was drinking, and I was drinking on Sundays, and alcohol got my ego back up, and I got out of there, and the next thing I know, I had an apartment, and I'm painting. That's what I do for a living. I'm painting, and I started drinking again, and I felt really good about myself, but then all of a sudden, I couldn't work. All I could do was drink. I supported my habit by going and getting drugs for people in the hood, because some of you Caucasian people are a little afraid to go there. So I would go get the drugs for you, and you would share them with me and get me, keep me drunk. All right? So that was it. Until one day, I was under the 15th Street Bridge, and I was getting ready to go to Kroger with my last $5, and I was going to get a quart of beer and a $2 breakfast. And all of a sudden, I started hallucinating like I did when I was 17 years old. And I knew that I'd only been drinking beer. I had been doing no drugs. And I knew that something was broke. You know, you're not supposed to hallucinate from drinking beer, because back in the day, I paid good money to hallucinate. And I didn't, you know, that didn't happen. So I looked up, and fortunately, I looked up and I seen the VA, and I heard that people got good government jobs at the VA. So I was going to walk there and get me a government job and maybe something to eat. That was my goal. When I woke up a couple days later, I was in a backless gown. I had one lens in my glasses. They'd feed me a sandwich, give me a pill, and send me back to bed. And I don't know how long that went on, but I know one day they woke me up and they said, "You're going to go talk to this counselor." And I did, and I went and talked to the counselor, and I sat down. He goes, "Do you know what your problem is?" And I said, "No, but I knew I had a problem." He said, "You're an alcoholic, and you can never drink again." And I sat there, and I looked at him for a minute, and I thought, okay, I can never drink again. What about Super Bowl Sunday? You know, because I'm from Pittsburgh area. You got to drink on Super Bowl Sunday. So he said no, but thank God it was June, and I didn't have the Super Bowl was a long way off. So he goes, "Do you want to join our homeless program?" And I did, and I said yes. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my first meeting was a speaker meeting, and the man was a young man, and he had done all the things I had done, not fifth step wise, but he had done all the things I had done, you know, experienced the homelessness and all that kind of stuff. And he had a light in his eyes, and he seemed to know what he was talking about. So I picked up a white chip, and that was roughly around June 1st of 1993. And I have not found it necessary to pick up another drink or drug on purpose ever since that day. And if you're applauding, I hope you're applauding God, because without him, I wouldn't be here today. So I was introduced to the program, and shortly things started happening, you know. I realized I was in the nut house. Even to this day, my favorite chip that I picked up was my 90-day chip. I was at my sponsor's home group at the time, and I picked up a 90-day chip, and my temporary sponsor said, "Would you like to go to another meeting and get another chip?" And I thought, well, yeah, man, I achieved 90 days. I wasn't even trying, and I did that. Well, I got there. We went to this meeting, and it was a big birthday meeting, and there were probably 150 people in the meeting. And when they got to the chips, I went up and got one. Well, there was a person there who was, I'll say, very mean. I'll just say that. And when I walked back, they said, "The only reason why you got that chip is because it's your ego. You think you're a big shot." And which, being 90 days sober, really hurt my feelings really hard. And I wanted to cry, and I went outside to smoke a cigarette and all that. I felt about this big, you know. So I get outside, though, and there was a girl walked up to me. She goes, "Can I see that chip?" And I was like, "Yeah." She goes, "90 days. She goes, "I only got like 27 days. I can't wait to be where you're at someday." And I thought, wow, that was the first time that I'd been an example. And I wasn't there for an ego trip. I was there just to do what I'm supposed to do in AA, and someone else benefited. And my sponsor has to keep reminding me that 30 years later. I have the same sponsor today that I had 30 years ago. And there had been lapses in between where I had interim sponsors, but he's my sponsor. So I did one. You know, figuring out that I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable was not that hard. I was in the nut house. I never met anybody who had been in the crazy house. No one I grew up with was in the crazy house. No one I went to the Army with had been to the Nut House. No one I went to college with had been to the Nut House. Even the people that I was on the street with never been to the Nut House. I was the only person I knew that had been to the Nut House. So apparently my life is unmanageable. And how did I know it was a Nut House and not a treatment center? Like they kept saying, this is the VA treatment center. Because every time I turned the corner, there was a sign that said psychiatry. You know? You look around, you see any signs in this building that say psychiatry? We're not in a Nut House, okay? So anyway, I get introduced to AA and I'm powerless and my life's unmanageable and the VA helps me get on my feet and they help me and guide me to get employment and get out and get an apartment and my sponsor says, you know what, you're going to start chairing meetings at Trinity Hospital where all the vets come to meetings, and I started doing that. So I was like, hey, man, I got a job, got a roof over my head, I'm useful, I'm on this pink cloud, it's really good. Let's see, step one, two, three, 12. I don't need to do all that stuff in between, all right? So anyway, that went on for a while, quite a few months, and I kept having this desire to drink really bad, especially every Friday. I'd have this overwhelming desire to drink. You know, it would be my mind couldn't shut up. My stomach would be turning over. I'd get off work, and you'd have to go do that pre-drink dump. You know what I mean? And get ready, and then I would be like, okay, I'm chairing a meeting. I'm not going to drink, because if I drink, then the meeting won't happen, and then these other people will relapse, and it'll be my fault. And that was the only thing. Service work kept me sober back then. But I was getting to the point where I hated you people. I hated you being happy. I hated you being joyous. I hated you being free. I hated you talking about the steps like you know what you're talking about, you know? So I decided it was either drink or do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was no middle-of-the-road solution. And I called my sponsor and I said, I'm ready to do step four. And we got together and we did the readings together and he gave me some forms. And there was sex and fear and resentment. And I went to one of my meetings up there at the VA, and the next thing I know, I was walking out of the meeting, and this is another spiritual experience. And as I looked over there, like way over in the corner, like where that corner of the room is, there was a piece of paper blowing across the parking lot. And it just kept blowing, and I'm walking, and I'm going to my bus. I didn't have a car then. And the paper's blowing, and I'm walking, and it blew right up to my feet. And I picked it up, and it was a Narcotics Anonymous four-step pamphlet. And I read it. And I called my sponsor and I said, you know, they got a couple, I did a lot of drugs in the middle of my drinking. Do you think maybe I could add a couple of these categories? And he said, sure, it'd be as thorough as possible. So I did fear, sex, resentment, times I felt victimized, shame and guilt, and I actually wrote down some assets. And my AA sponsor didn't kick me to the curb. He said, just bring it all to me. But before I brought it to him, I called him, because I was used to calling him every day, you know. I called him up the first day, and I said, I'm done with this four step. And you ain't a no-good SOB, and you're going to tell everybody all my secrets, and I don't trust you. You ain't no good. And I hung up. Well, I was used to calling them every day, so I called them up a second day in a row, and I said, well, I don't know what to do with it. I think I'm going to just tear this thing up, because I think you're just going to tell everybody in AA about what all the stuff I did, and the stuff I did is probably worse than everybody else did, you know. And he said, and I hung up. Oh, I called him the third day, because I was used to calling my sponsor every day, and he said, before you get started, he said, why don't you do it just like the book says? Why don't you take that and stand in front of a mirror and read it to yourself? And then when you're done with that, why don't you get on your knees and read it to God? And then why don't you bring it to me? And I was like, wow, that sounds pretty cool. That sounds good enough. And that's exactly what I did. And when I got there, I did the fifth step, and the fifth step promises come true. I guarantee you, I can look at anybody in this room and look in the eyes, because I didn't do that before. I walked around down like this. You know, I wasn't worthy to look anybody in the eye, but I could do that after the fifth step. I found out my sponsor, who I had put on this big pedestal, he was a human being, because he had done some of this stuff I did, and he shared that with me, and that was an awesome thing, that I wasn't alone in the world. Oh, and you know what I found out? I didn't invent any new sins. Nope. Nope, they all been done before. I just participated, you know, but I didn't invent nothing new. Jesus don't have to come back down and redo the cross. Well, Gilbert invented a new one. I got to do a do-over. No, that's not the way it works. So at any rate, when we got to step 6 and 7, and I had my list of what I call home team character defects. And the idea was, I thought you only had to work on one character defect at a time, but I found out they usually come with friends, you know. So while I'm working on one character defect, God's helping me with something else. And I don't work on character defects. I work on practicing the opposite spiritual principle today. If I'm feeling prideful, I need to just gain some humility. I can't be procrastinating and diligent at the same time, you know. So I figured that out, you know. I can be fearful and practice faith at the time, same time, because faith is what conquers fear. I heard a good saying the other day that, I don't know, forgot what it was. I'm getting old. 65 years old, man. I can't remember everything. So at any rate, I'm working on spiritual principles, and I get to step 9. I'm sold on AA after step 5. Oh, by the way, step 5 is where the first time I ever lied to my sponsor, because I had all this dirt, and I said, like, I'll never do that again. But then, you know what? We have desires that oppose the grace of God, and I was like, well, wonder what it's like when I'm sober. So then we have to work on that. I had to work. Then I found out I could work the steps situationally. Like, I could hardly have a hard time keeping a job, so I had to learn to shut up, you know, and that my boss is a higher power, and that, you know what, I have to work the steps on letting my boss be a higher power. So I did that. I had to work the steps on relationships, how I relate to other people, because I was not really good at that. I'm not even good at that today a lot of times. So, but I found out I could work them situationally. When you get unemployed and everything's a disaster, guess what? You're powerless. You're insane. Guess what? You can work the steps on that too. But anyway, I get to step 9. And I start doing amends, and I loved amends. Man, I was getting great, great results until I called up the student loan people. And they said, and this is what they said, no, you're going to have to pay that, but you're going to pay interest on the interest. And I was like, is this like a Three Stooges joke? You know, the interest on the interest, but it didn't. But God worked that out too. Somehow, some way, that against all laws of the United States, I did a bankruptcy on student loans. I don't know how that happened, but that was a God thing, letting me out of debt. So I start step 10, and then I start sponsoring people. You know, I have a couple of years of sobriety under my belt then, and sponsoring people was a wonderful thing to do. Carrying the message that my sponsor carried to me, that his sponsor carried to him, that guy's sponsor carried, you know. It's one-on-one recovery with the next suffering alcoholic. And that is the key to sobriety. And like I said, there's a whole bunch of other ways to get sober now. But the real deal is one alcoholic working with another is the linchpin of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can read about our principles anywhere. Christian books, Hindu books, Buddhist books, you know, the principles are universal, but that working with the next suffering alcoholic is the linchpin that keeps us sober one day at a time. So that's what happened. I worked the steps and I got sober and I got sane and somewhat. And so you might ask, well, what's it like being 30 years sober? Well, one of the things about 30 years, why I'm 30 years sober, is because early on I came to believe in something called permanent sobriety. You know, I didn't make it up. It's in our literature in step 3 in the 12 and 12. See, because you people were so happy and so joyful and so free, I didn't like it. I could not get down with Happy, Joyous, and Free because I was a self-pity-based person. But when I read the 12 and 12, and it said that I could be content and useful, I could get down with that. And it said that can only happen through permanent sobriety and a continued effort on these steps as a way of life. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to tell you something. The good thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it's a way of life. The bad thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it's a way of life. You know, because when you want to go do X, Y, and Z, maybe go have some fun with family and friends, and that suffering alcoholic calls you, you got to put your family and friends aside and do what you need to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor showed me that. My sponsor showed me a lot of things, some good and some bad, because he's a human being. I sponsor people today, and there's the one thing they don't tell you about sponsoring people. Sponsees are no good. I don't want to tell you why. You know, they're good most of the time. But what they do is stuff like this. And this just happened the other day. I had a problem, and I was complaining because someone does not talk to me anymore. And I was like, man, this guy don't talk to me anymore. And we did A together, and we did this and that. And the person looks at me, and they said, well, Gilbert, remember what you told me? People are in your life for a reason or a season or a lifetime. And maybe that person was only in your life for a season. I was like, I don't like you sponsees. You know? I had another sponsee to say, hey, you know what your problem is? I said, No, I have no idea. And he says, you think you're always right. And I said, you're wrong. Jeez, you know, these sponsees tear me up. And, you know, another sponsee I was given, he had a problem, I think, with his girlfriend or job or parents or something. And then I gave him this big, giant lecture. And you know what he said to me? You know what you need, Gilbert? And I said, no, I don't. And he says, you need a nice big glass of shut up. You know? And I was like, dang, these people are human beings. They're not like little minutes. They're supposed to just follow me around. They're not minions, you know? So, today I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm just another member of AA. But you know what? When I get the chance, I'm going to tell my sponsor he has to have a nice big glass of shut up. You know, I'm waiting to do that. He just hasn't done anything wrong yet. But when he does, boy, I'm going to be there. So that's about all I got to say, you know. God has blessed me with sobriety. You know, I have a roof over my head today. I have a job today. I have friends today. I have fellowship today. My family was restored. Before my mother passed, I had 15 years to go back and do amends while she had Alzheimer's and stuff. I'm a cancer treatment survivor. I've had to go to, during those 30 years, had depression and anxiety and had to go get outside help. And you know what's funny about outside help? Let me tell you what. I had a social worker and a psychologist, and I had lost my job where I made lots of money and stuff, and I was just crying the blues. And you know what they told me? You just need to accept where you're at. I was like, really? I could have got that from AA. You know? Then they told me, nothing in God's world happens by mistake. You're not going to die. Do you see any skeletons alongside the road? I'm like, dude, who's your sponsor? You know? So, I don't know. So sobriety goes on. But I said all that to say this, and I know that guy told me if I go too long, he's going to cut me off, so... And I don't want to bore the heck out of you, but I said all that to say this. They're to carry you the message to AA. And here's the message of AA in a nutshell. You never have to drink again one day at a time if you just follow a few simple rules. All right, so what are the few simple rules? Don't drink, go to meetings, pray, read some literature, call your sponsor, and work whatever step you're on. And if you try to do those six things each day, you will still stay sober that day. And if you do that and you still, and right now to the newcomers, if you still have that desire to drink and drug, if you do those six things, that desire will be removed. And that's a guarantee. So I thank you all for being bored for an hour. And hopefully we'll meet again here in 30 years and I'll get to do it again. Thank you for letting me share.